Thanks for listening to Photo Geek Weekly, Episode 6. This is recorded on December 12th, 2017. I'm your host, Don Komarechka, and in the co-pilot seat today is a good buddy of mine, Sharky James. How you doing today, sir?
I'm doing great. It's an honor to be here, my friend.
An honor. Well, you don't know what you're getting yourself into just yet. You might change your opinion by the time we get through the news of the week in total geeky fashion here. But before we get to that, Sharky, what's new and exciting in your neck of the woods?
Oh, you know, I still host the Petapixel Photography Podcast, a show that I created, which later became the Petapixel Photography Podcast. We're 230 something odd shows deep now, and then I host the No Name Photo Show with Brian Matiash. That's a great show.
And I've listened
as well
to you guys ramble and go off the rails a number of times. It's vaguely entertaining.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I guess that takes up most of your time, right? I mean, you do the Petapixel Podcast twice a week plus the No Name Photo Show. It's got to be pretty intensive.
It's 14 to 16 hour days pretty much every day of the week, but I'm a workaholic. So, and my family knows where to find me.
Exactly. I hear you, especially this time of the year. I work way too much. Although this past weekend, me and the family just had a little side trip to Montreal, which was great. But, you know, traveling with a toddler, and that's a 6-hour drive in both directions over a weekend. So, you know, 12 hours in a car with an 18-month-old is not exactly easy going.
But on the upside, you got a chance to practice your French.
I did. Je ne parle pas français.
Whatever you said.
Exactly. I studied French, as most people do in Canada, from the early levels of elementary school all the way until about grade 9, where it was mandatory. And all I can come away with is saying, I do not speak French in French, which is a bit of an oxymoron, but that's where it stops.
It's so pretty darn weird.
It is.
Cool.
It is. My wife's originally from Bulgaria, and so we go back every summer, and I learn more of that language than I do of French. And it's really interesting because, you know, if you've ever had the opportunity to study any language based on the Cyrillic alphabet, you can't mispronounce a word. Like every character only has one sound that it could possibly make. Whereas French, they just throw in like 5 extra letters that are never a part of the sounds that you make. And it's very confusing.
Oh, trust me. I could probably mess up Russian, Bulgarian, all those.
Oh, well, what is your background anyways, Mike? I mean, I'm assuming then that you don't speak any other languages.
No, my background, what? Ethnically, or are you talking about professionally?
I mean, ethnically. You don't sound like you've got any foreign accents. So,
I've lived all over the United States. I've lived in California. I've lived in Pennsylvania. Originally from Chicago, Illinois. Was down in Arizona for 24 years. So my accent is all over the darn place.
Cool. Definitely not a Canadian accent, but we forgive you.
No way, eh?
No way.
You hoser.
Yes. Oh, you hoser, eh? Okay. So let's get into the stories before we get too far off the rails. Story number one, which is kind of going on the heels of what we talked about last week, is that Lytro, they've had some big announcements for their cinema products. But a few years ago, they pretty much abandoned the consumer marketplace with their kind of financial failure or commercial failure of the Lytro Illume. And just this past week, they also canned the servers that are going to be hosting their, I guess it would be called their live picture or their live focus, whatever the term that they would use, for people to share images taken by that camera, and shuttered it. Anybody that had shared those images, embedded them into any website, they're all broken now. But there is a glimmer of hope. They are not against potentially open sourcing that platform, which I think would be really fun. There's some licensing and probably some patent issues, some code that they might have been using behind the scenes that they can't open source that and they can't give it freely away. If they could overcome those hurdles, I think this could be a really fun platform and possibly allow a bit of resurgence into this light field camera tech, not just from Lytro, but if this becomes an open standard platform, I think anybody that wants to make a camera like this could jump on board, sort of like the Micro Four Thirds system for camera mounts. Anybody can make a lens or a camera body compatible to that. Have you ever had any interest in light field photography, Mike?
No.
No, none whatsoever.
Yeah. And the technology is great. You see where it's going, but this was a technology without a market right now. It just wasn't fully fleshed out. That I've seen the lipstick cam from back in the day. This was 2011. I think I saw it in about 2012 or so. You know, you have to shoot these things properly. You want to get some depth in there. So you want something in your foreground, pretty darn close to it. And my thinking is, if you're going to do this, if you're going to go through all this trouble so you can refocus later, why not just take the time to take two or three shots, you know, focused in different places and call it good, unless you want that experience where you can then embed that photo and then have somebody be able to readjust their focus. And I think at that point, it's a bit of a gimmick.
It is a bit of a gimmick. It's kind of like it has to be done well. Like, for example, a movie narrative plays out exactly the way that you intend to as a director. There's no side trips. Whereas a video game, for example, gives the viewer, the player, the ability to take that narrative into their own hands. And in some way, I think that this light field technology functions similarly, where you're giving control of that narrative to the viewer. Should you? And in my opinion, I don't like the viewer to have that kind of control. It's got to be buttoned down. It has to be my vision of what they should be seeing. And I feel like I should be in control of that. However, there are some circumstances on the fringe that I could find viable for this kind of work, especially when you're getting very close focusing on something. And I have no idea, because I haven't had the opportunity to get my hands on one of these cameras, if you can modify it with a close-up filter or something to get even closer. But for a lot of my macro work, wouldn't it be fun to focus on like a water droplet in the foreground that has a flower inside of it, and then shift the focus to the actual flower in the background and forward and back? That could be a really fun play on understanding the concept of how those images are created. There is room for possibility here, but would I go out and spend the multiple hundreds of dollars on this obscure camera and now currently have no way to use it? Yeah, I don't know. I think that it's not just before its time. I don't know if its time will ever come.
See, what you've described is a really tiny market for this. You know, like something really specific. The 17 people out there who want to adjust focus on a water droplet on a flower.
Exactly.
It's probably more than that, but come on, it's not there's no business model there.
There is not. And it would be really cool if you could play with, some funky bokeh in the background and bring that in and out of focus too. I could come up with about a dozen little niches that could play into a possible market for this. But unless you get some really AAA material to advertise it and to get units sold and to change people's mentality about photography in general, which I don't think you're going to be able to do, even if this platform gets open sourced, I don't think it's necessarily going to take off. I'd like to see it. I'd like to see this be something, but the public mentality just isn't there.
You know, it would be another tool in the toolbox if you could have this in a regular camera, which of course you cannot. Because you need to have the varying angles and all that sort of thing, right, for this technology. And you want to be able to control the experience. So then VR and 360, you might not be a huge fan of, I'm guessing.
Well, I mean, not necessarily for my own work, although I do enjoy good, VR content. I haven't had a chance to watch a lot of 3D movies and things like that. But if you could adapt that to have 6 degrees of motion and give you a little bit of control to feel like you're inside the action, then yeah, there's value there for sure. Sort of in a related topic, have you seen the reviews that are trickling out for the Light L16 camera?
I have, and it's a horror fest. People don't seem to be super happy with it. I don't think I've seen a photo yet that was super impressive. I get it. You know, it's a fun toy. If you're a rich guy, a rich gal, and you want to spend, what is this, like $1,000 plus for this camera? So you have something that's kind of flat, that kind of brick format, almost like a phone, to be able to do these things that this light L16 can do. Great. But if you zoom in on the images and you look at the detail, it's not very impressive to me.
So for those that haven't seen this camera, it's got 16 different lenses, different focal lengths and positions, somewhat haphazardly placed on the front of this thing, like a Frankenstein, like somebody just took a bunch of point and shoot cameras and cell phone cameras and just kind of stuck them all inside of this body. And I'm thinking, okay, well, computationally, if behind the scenes you could stitch all of this together perfectly, then this could be a really novel tool, because you won't have necessarily moving parts. Very, like you mentioned, a very, very small camera just fits right in your pocket, but incredibly capable. The problem comes down to the software and how these images are all interpreted and combined and stitched together. If you look closely at almost any image that are in these reviews, and I'm pretty sure people are cherry picking bad ones just to illustrate it, but you can see the seams where these images are put together, and man, it is just awful. It's like if you put together a panorama in Photoshop and one of your images is out of focus and you see the weird jaggy line that connects the two of them together, that is all these images are. And to me, I'm thinking, okay, well, maybe the hardware is right. Maybe they got the hardware perfect and it's just the software and whatever artificial intelligence engine that has to be built behind the scenes. I don't know if they're going to get to a product revision 2 at this stage. They're kind of in the same boat as Lytro. If they do, it's going to be their swan song.
They've got some incredibly smart people working on this thing and have for years, and this was the best they could come up with.
Yeah.
So,
but at the same time, we're seeing some great like proof of concepts in artificial intelligence stuff from NVIDIA and their deep learning engines and all the research that's going into that. If you could productize that so that it's not just a tech demo, this would be a great example of how you could productize that, how you could use an artificial intelligent engine to stitch these together and redraw things if the images didn't capture it properly.
Either it works or it doesn't, right? And it has to. When you take a photo with a DSLR, a mirrorless camera, you zoom way in, everything looks great. With this, yeah, not so much. So you're on the bleeding edge with this camera. If you're okay with that and you got an extra $1,000 or whatever burning a hole in your pocket and you don't have high expectations, this is the camera for you.
Yes. And so, you know, Rich Uncle Joe with his collection of Leicas and very expensive lenses, when there are equally capable cameras that are just an alternative, or the people that bought into the, was it the Yashica?
The Y35.
The Y35, yeah, where you you throw in film canisters that are basically just camera setting modules to change your digital camera into different modes. They made $1.25 million in funding on that project. So, you know what? A fool and their money are easily parted, although I was so close to buying one of those things.
It looks like fun. It might be something that you'd put on your shelf and you might let the kids play with, but come on. Changing your ISO by popping in different film canisters and then going through the trouble to wind it. Come on, just go get yourself a regular film camera.
Exactly. And there's more film on the market now than there has been in many years in the past. So, all right. Crazy world we live in with all of these cameras coming out with multiple lenses and light fields and all this stuff that try to reinvent photography when the Yashica Y35 really is telling us that the consumers have a desire to go back to our roots, one way or another, misguided as some of those attempts may be.
Computational photography is the future, but it's not going to get so far off the rails that you're like, look at it. There's that Arsenal product that's coming out in February. They raised something like $2.6 million, and it does a lot of the thinking for you. It assists you, just like I think VR. I don't want to spend all day in a virtual reality world. I don't want to mess around with 360 all day long. People want to see things the way they see with their eyes. Augmented reality helps extend your world. I think that is the future. I think that's where most people are going to get the benefit from computational photography and the stuff that's done behind the scenes.
Wouldn't it be great if we have the ability to like just see full 360 or holographic displays on our cell phone and just have that in every phone? And it's just it is the norm that becomes our augmented reality. And that'll happen, I think, because that does not change anything away from the path that we're currently going down.
Absolutely. It's going to be here. It's just not here yet. Just look at the light field technology.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Story number two that we're talking about here is something that you've probably seen or at least glanced by, if you're listening to this. Some footage of a polar bear starving has gone viral. And this is really interesting from a journalism perspective. And I wanted to bring this up because people are trumpeting this as a sign of the damages of global warming. And the footage is very iconic to that specific message. Have you seen this, Sharky?
I have. In fact, I saw it. How could you miss it? I submitted it to the mothership, as I call it, petapixel.com. And we ran it. It's been shared thousands of times just on Petapixel. Millions upon millions of people have seen this. It's sad. I feel I'm not heartless. If I was there, it might have, you know, brought a tear to my eye. Animals are dying all over the planet and have. People are too. And what can you do? You know, I mean, just at a certain point, look, if you live out in the country, you know, you see a lot of death. You're used to, if you're a farmer, you see this happens, right?
A wildfire kicks up, and we've had so many of them this year all across North America. How many animals have died from that in the worst possible way? It sucks. But, you know, when you dive deeper into this, you'll quickly realize that that bear is probably not dying of anything related to climate change at all. There have been some experts that chimed in on this. And, you know, there's a Twitter thread that I had followed. And, you know, just to quote some of this here, it was like, so to consider this bear to be any way representative of the bears in the population, whichever one it's from, would be incorrect and misleading. And to continue on, now, for what I think being the opportune word, not having any certainty, is going on with this particular polar bear is it has an aggressive form of cancer, osteosarcoma of some variety, which is known to afflict polar bears and grizzly bears as well. And so you look at this poor, wasted away bear that could very well be dying of cancer. And that sucks. I feel for this bear. But it's interesting how society can kind of jump right on to the bandwagon and say, we need some mascot for climate change. Let's make it this dying polar bear and share this to try and change opinions. Where the people that are trumpeting for climate change, the truly educated scientists, are looking at this and saying, no, this has nothing to do with climate change whatsoever. Thank you for the support, but please do so in other ways.
Listen, I'm not a scientist, so, you know, I don't have a dog in this hunt, as they say, or a polar bear in this hunt, for that matter. You go and you see not a whole lot of snow, so all right, well, it all melted, global warming, and they run with that narrative. So, you know, I'm not going to, the experts, and listen, it's almost 2018 as we record this, right, in December 2017. We can't even here in my country especially, even agree on what are facts anymore. You know, there's facts, there's alternative facts, there's fake news, there's real news disguised as fake news, there's actual fake news. You don't know what is what anymore. It's confusing and it's a little disconcerting. All I know is I see this polar bear. It's probably dead now.
It is.
Osteosarcoma, that's bone cancer, right? So it suffered, but how many billions of animals have suffered? And like I said, I'm not heartless. I feel bad for this bear, but we don't know the entire story, and, you know, who knows? Just who knows?
Yeah, they should, you know, if anything, an URSA osteosarcoma awareness fund should be started for polar bears like this and others. But no, nobody really cares about what afflicted this bear if it has no impact on them. And so at the end of the day, this is not exactly a fake news story, but it is being misrepresented. And, you know, journalism as a whole is kind of going down the toilet a little bit. And this is just the tip of the iceberg, I suppose.
So to speak. The tip of the iceberg.
So to speak. And,
but what we can say is this is incredibly sad imagery. If you look at this and you at least don't go, well, that sucks at the most heartless, you know, form, or be saddened by this because it's sad. You're seeing an animal that's dying or, you know, will be dead soon, probably dead right now. It's sad.
Good cinema, good photography is powerful. It doesn't have to be positive. It just has to be powerful. It has to make you think. It has to make you feel. And it certainly accomplishes that goal here. So kudos to the film crew that was able to capture this footage. And, you know, one of the reasons why I like watching nature documentaries is because you get to see the good, the bad, and the ugly. And you know, I feel kind of odd sitting there thinking, okay, well, you know, you could save this, you know, baby elephant's life or whatever. And instead you're just watching it getting mauled to death by lions, but that's what's happening. You're just there to document it. You're not there to necessarily intervene. So, I guess that's all to be said about that, but wanted to bring some of the facts to light on that particular story that most people have probably come across in the last couple of days. So then, this next one, Cherokee, this one hits close to home for me because I've had some, I don't want to say horror stories, but some really depressing moments when it comes to stock photo agencies. And this one's regarding Adobe's new stock photo agency, where somebody earned literally pennies. They were supposed to get 25 cents and 7 cents from that was even held back. So they were looking at an 18 cent sale from Adobe stock, which was claiming, I believe, to be much more fair to the content creators than other similar agencies. And what do you think about this? And have you had any run-ins with MicroStock yourself?
I have not. Back in the day, I sold, you know, my imagery as stock. Not a whole lot, but I dabbled in that. And there was a book, it's probably still out there. It's called Photographer's Market. It was a thick book, a hardcover book, and you'd go through there, you'd see who the point person was. Year by year, it came out and what their submission guidelines were, et cetera. You could send them back then. You would send slides, you know, we called them chromes, right? They weren't negatives. And they would consider whether or not they were going to use that image. And you could make a decent living at that. And you had an entire stock library in your office, your home, wherever, that you would manage yourself. These days, it's all digital. You have it on various services. You get paid. There's exclusive rates. And then you have, you know, your, if you have it on the different services, you get a little bit less or whatever. But people aren't getting as much as they used to.
Well, especially when you've got a an agency that says, oh, you know, hey, you big corporation, come to us, buy in bulk. You'll get 1,000 downloads for, you know, your yearly usage, and you're going to pay us, you know, $500. Well, that's a very small amount of money per image that people are paying for in bulk, where they might license for $10 if they're buying just a single license, and let's say $5 of those dollars goes to the photographer. But when you buy in bulk, half of whatever it costs for that image goes to the content creator. And so in that case, the company paid 50 cents for the image, the photographer gets 25 cents and then you're off to cry all by your lonesome.
I was going to say, who does the business model benefit? It benefits the stock agencies and it also benefits those buying. The photographer, you're just the supplier and it's almost a commodity at this point.
Yeah, well, the photographer is the product, and everybody is using you. I had some images on iStock Photo when I was kind of dipping my toes in all the waters and throwing everything against the wall and to see what sticks and all that stuff as I started my career. And I was just checking my website referral list, and I noticed that I was linked to from the journal Nature, and I'm thinking, well, that's got to be a mistake somehow. But cool, let's go check that out. Well, apparently, one of my snowflake photographs was used on the cover of the journal Nature Structural and Molecular Biology. And I got paid $1.18 or something for it, like just over $1 for that cover shot. And so I'm thinking, okay, well, that really sucks. A nice feather in my cap to say, yeah, I'm on the cover of the journal Nature. But okay, you know, let's take that and run with it. Let's put a framed copy of that on my wall just to, you know, impress anybody that walks by. And you know how much it costs for a single issue when you don't have a subscription to the journal Nature?
Isn't it like $20 or something?
No, and it's like something like $300 or $400. I can't remember, but it was just close. Like some obscene. I emailed them and they graciously sent me a copy with compliments. But yeah, you know, if I were to get a cover shot on, and I mean, I'll be transparent here. I've had cover shots on Outdoor Photography Canada magazine, which I write for in every issue, and the payout on that is $600. And so there's a big difference between somebody that's legitimately contacting you directly to license a photograph for publication or to be printed, or I've had people even build them into products. And for every one of those cases, I get paid fairly because I set the rates. But if I were to be licensing my images through a stock photo agency, then that is absolutely no money that that I could ever depend on. I think I made a total of $200 on iStock Photo for the year or so that I was there. And it's not a business model I want to be a part of.
Think about it. The Journal Nature or whatever it is, they spent more on postage than they paid for your image probably, right?
Yes, they did. And
at a dollar an image... You could sell, which isn't going to happen, probably not. You could sell that 1,000 times. That still ain't $1,000. Like, everyone keeps asking me to do t-shirts, right? You know, every podcast, a lot of podcasts have t-shirts. I could make a dollar off of each t-shirt and sell 1,000 of them. That's still only $1,000. You have to do incredible
Look at the company that made the t-shirt and the shipping company, and everybody else is getting a much bigger piece of the pie than you ever will.
Exactly. So I think the point of this is it's probably not a good idea as a photographer. If you're aiming to make money, it's not going to be in micro stock. You would be much better off building a name for yourself, having your collection online. You can have your own private library online and have it locked up and have people order through you and make more money that way and control the distribution. A lot of times you might sell, as you know, your images for micro stock, and they're all over the web and you have no idea where they're at. And so who do you hunt down to try to enforce your copyright?
Yeah, well, I deal with that on a daily basis. And so I use Image Rights International and they handle a lot of my cases overseas and in the US. I've got a local lawyer here in Canada that he is just absolutely fantastic. And we just got another settlement that was paid out yesterday, actually. So I was pretty happy about that. But this kind of stuff, in terms of licensing and copyright issues, I will be honest and say that I've made more from copyright infringement settlements in the last year than I did from actually licensing my work.
I heard you say, and I think it was last episode, there's a company out there that would rather pay payouts than it would to go ahead and license the images because that's cheaper for them. And there's also people out there that are, and it's a legitimate business model. It's a little shifty. There's people that put out their images in full res as a honeypot, hoping that someone will steal it, and then they go hunt them down and then sue them. Now, granted, that's well, think about it. So that's a little weird, a little creepy, but you know, it's like setting a trap, right? It's like a sting. If someone's going to steal your images, they should be sued, right? That's copyright infringement. Whether that's your business model or not, it's a weird business model, but I think it's legitimate. Someone shouldn't be stealing your image. You're not forcing them to steal your image, but I know that people do that.
Yeah, and it's interesting to think about this from a perspective of the end consumer, because the public knowledge or the public perception of copyright is so far off of the actual law that a lot of people commit copyright violations on a daily basis, and they have no idea what they've done and what the ramifications could potentially be. Now, if you're a company doing it, that's really where it changes from a slap on the wrist to a letter from a lawyer. But at the end of the day, I think that every photographer should at least take some action to find where their images are being misappropriated and let people know, hey, this is not okay. Whichever way you want to make that message clear. If we all do it, then public perception will change to some degree, I hope. But that's not going to happen. So I'll just sit here and complain about it.
It's okay. You can say sorry.
Yes, I can say sorry.
I had to get that in there. That's my last Canadian reference.
You might come up with another. I want to wind down. Typically, we only have three major stories, but this one was just too interesting and totally in the realm of what we talk about on the show. Have you ever seen a mantis shrimp up close and personal, Sharky?
I have not. Despite my moniker, I have not seen many crustaceans and other sea life like this one.
So I had no idea that these guys had such cool eyes. You know, the human vision has three types of cones in them to see the color spectrum that we have, and rods to detect luminance. But these guys, these mantis shrimps, they have 16 different receptors for color and brightness, I'm assuming, along with six that are dedicated just to detect polarized light. And I mean, I have no idea how their brain computes all of this into something that is meaningful for their survival. But research is being done into this polarized light technology. And there's a camera it looks like a standard camera. It's got like a Canon L series lens, and it might have some special filters and stuff on it that are trying to mimic some of this this visual perception. Now, it's not just like putting a polarized filter on your camera, because that just lets in polarized light in one direction and that's all you're detecting. But what if you were able to isolate light that is polarized in multiple different directions all at the same time within the same image? And how could that create something interesting? This is scientific, and this is a really cool science experiment here. I've been known to take science experiments and turn them into some fun art projects as well. So I'm really keen to see how this goes. This probably means nothing to you, though, right, Sharky?
I'm just glad you're not using $100 words, because you're definitely, listen, this is the geekiest photography podcast out there, right? So you're a super nerd. And that's a compliment. How would this translate into cameras that we care about, DSLRs and mirrorless cameras? Could you put this technology in there, and why would you want to use it as a photographer?
Well, here's an example. A polarizing filter that you're using, like as a filter in the front of your camera, you'll rotate that filter to dial in the effect. But what if you could do that afterwards? What if you could detect the polarization of light and have that recorded by the image sensor so that you no longer ever have to put a polarizing filter on your camera? If you take a picture and you want the reflections to disappear, then you just, the information is there because you can cancel out that light from the sensor. Or maybe you want to have a reflection fade away like a gradient across a frame. Well, you could do that as well if this was into a commercial product. So yeah, there is viable ways for you to possibly use this if it was a fundamental part of your camera tech. This is much more scientific, and they say that for $100 worth of parts, which means this is really just they stuck some stuff together and it does something neat. But if this does end up being a study on light polarization that turns into a viable commercial product, even on a scientific level, it would be a really fun thing to experiment with. I've had the opportunity to get my hands on some of the Phantom high-speed cameras and that sort of tech that when they're running, those like larger scientific cameras, they sound like a vehicle's engine is running because of all the fans and stuff that are just keeping that thing cool. So
they're the cost of a house. They're like $150,000.
Oh, I don't even know if you can buy them. I think that they just rent them, and you hire an operator to handle all the setup and everything. And you know, it's got its own desk, and it's really quite a wonderful thing. But
comes with your own Sherpa,
just about. So if this tech were to get to that level of scientific commercialization, we still probably would never see it in our own cameras. So the wishful thinking of being able to apply a polarizing filter after the fact, I think is still just wishful thinking at this point. But the fact that creatures out there see polarized light was news to me. And now I have to try and figure out, you know, I'm experimenting with ultraviolet and seeing how insects see things. I think snakes can see in infrared. And if creatures can see polarized light, well, maybe there's something interesting to see. And I'm all for exploring it. So who knows? Maybe that'll be the next project for me.
You know, I think in 10 years' time, we're going to have so much tech in our cameras that we can't even fathom right now. We might have this in our cameras. We're not going to have the light field technology because that's going to require multiple lenses and all kinds of just weird stuff that you might not have in a camera that you would actually want to hold and use. That's what it comes down to. Are you going to actually use it? But this sort of computational photography, and like, look at all the cameras out there. There's a lot of video cameras and I think regular cameras as well that have ND filters built into them. We could have that in our cameras right now.
Yeah,
but we don't.
Yeah,
and, you know? And there's all kinds of things you could add.
Exactly. There are a lot of cinema cameras that will have three separate sensors for each color that they're recording. And even with the new pixel shift technology, Sony that rolled out with their A7R III, and it's in a lot of other cameras, but you can basically cover every pixel with the red, green, and blue color filter, which equivocates it to like a Foveon type camera sensor that that Sigma has been trying to promote and sell for a very long time and has had no real commercial success with either. And now it's obsolete because this pixel shift technology, at least for static subjects, pretty much replaces it. This innovation that we have, people are no longer really clamoring over megapixels. I think once we hit the almost 50 megapixel mark, nobody really cares for more than that and can really use much more than that. The limits of physics also state that diffraction is going to blur the heck out of anything if you try to cram more in there anyhow. But the innovations are going to come in different ways now. Better low light performance, sure, that's evolutionary on what we have. But I'm not going to go out and buy a new camera just because it's a little bit better in low light or has a few more megapixels. I've got the Canon 1DX Mark II, which is a beast of a camera, and it's a phenomenal camera. I'm going to keep that thing probably for about 6, 7, 8 years, unless there is something that truly changes the industry that is put into a commercial flagship camera. And when that happens, I'll jump on it right away. But until then, I'm happy with what I got.
Well, look, you need faster computers. You need more hard drive space. So anything anything beyond 24 megapixels or so is, I think, too much for most people.
Yep, exactly.
Right. And so what I want, and I say this on my shows, is it would be nice to shoot at 12,800 ISO or ISO if you're Tony Northrup. And then, and I know that's how you pronounce it, but I don't care. It's ISO to me. It always will be. I'm a rebel. And so it'd be nice to shoot at 12,800 and have it look like ISO 100 does now. That would be great. You know, your average person who's shooting little Johnny's or little Sally's, you know, basketball game or whatever in a really horrible junior high gym, what do they need? They need more ISO that looks less noisy. That's what people want. They don't want to shoot these, you know, fish in the sea with ultraviolet.
Yep. But this is not the normal person's photography podcast.
Look who you have on it. Me. And you, of course.
Well, yeah, but at the same time, you know, all of these kind of fringe things that we talk about here, they are redefining photography in some really interesting, fun, and unexpected ways. I think that 5 years from now, that photography will be fundamentally different than it is today. Cell phones have changed it drastically from what it used to be, and that's going to continue. There's going to be more pictures taken every second. Artificial intelligence and computational photography is going to take off over that time period. And then we're going to have products that will use that effectively, and then all bets are off. I mean, if you want to take a photograph of a famous landmark and then have the camera automatically give it just the most stunning sunset imaginable, that can happen in camera within a few years. And that kind of ruins photography for me in some ways, because that just perpetuates the whole fake news idea all the way through the arts.
You know, this technology might actually force people to think about composition and making a better photograph. I think it's going to separate. Well, the old reference used to be the boys from the men, but these days, the women from the little girls. I don't know. You know what I'm saying? This is maybe true photography will come back because everyone will have access to this technology, and you're going to have to actually make a darn photograph for once.
And maybe that's why people are enjoying film photography now more than they were a few years ago. It's more tangible. It's more real in some ways as the technology puts photography more and more into some realm of fantasy than the reality that we live in.
Yeah, go shoot your analog film, get it scanned digital, and get to where I've got right now shooting digital. I call them the cranky film guys on my show.
It's the experience, Sharky. I mean, some people love listening to a vinyl record. I don't, but I understand that some people enjoy that experience as part of the process of enjoying their music.
And yet they don't own a darkroom. Now, I know I give them a lot of crap, but It's why I love my Fujifilm X-T2. It's a more tactile experience. It reminds me of my old Nikon FM2 and a lot of cameras I had back in the day. For me, I like that part of it. I don't like putting the film in there, winding it, sending it off, spending more money, etc. But to each their own, of course. Whatever makes you happy.
Whatever makes you happy. And hopefully listening to this podcast has made you happy as well. We are supported by you, great listeners. If you are interested in supporting us, there is a Patreon link on our website at photogeekweekly.com and a tip jar there as well. If you want to buy me a coffee or a beer, I would be more than happy to accept that. So before we sign off to the ether here, Sharky, where can people find you, and what is the big project that you might have in the works, or the next thing that you want to take a photograph of? What keeps your mojo going photographically?
I'm so busy these days, as everybody who listens to my shows know. I do a lot of portraiture when I get a chance these days. It's cold out, so I'm shooting a lot more indoors, so I'm photographing my family and friends and that sort of thing. But the Petapixel Photography Podcast keeps me busy. That's PETAPIXEL, the Petapixel Photography Podcast, and also No Name Photo Show with Brian Matiash. You can find me on social media everywhere, Lens Shark. Don't forget the two S's in the middle there. I think that's about it. I'm working on a book. Can't talk about that. That's an ongoing project, a multi-year project, as if I'm not busy or crazy enough as it is. But I have to do it. It's one of those things. It's like photography. It's like, if you're really passionate about something, you have to do it, right?
You got to. And if you don't take on those passionate projects, then it just becomes like any other job and it's just a clock in and clock out. Except, you know, as well as I do, you can't do that. It lives inside your head 24/7. And so if you hate what you do and it's living inside your head, then, you know, you have to inject some of that passion back into it whenever you can.
That's why I work 14 to 16 hour days every darn day of the week, because I love it and I'm crazy.
Well, I think we all are. Thanks for being here, Sharky. I really appreciate you being on the podcast. And, you know, hopefully we'll have you back on at some point in the future.
Awesome. Be my honor.
All right. Thanks.